This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
So, funny story before we get to our next interview. We were looking to get our next guest, Dave Leventhal, on. And I was giving Josh the number for another Dave L. in my phone. So, I mean, he's going to know it's me because who else from the 716 is calling him? But we thought Leventhal, we thought Dave was not answering his phone, but I was giving the wrong Dave L. So that's I probably should label things better in my phone. But, you know, I digress. Our next guest is Dave Leventhal from Business Insider. And, of course, the first question I have to ask, Dave, how do you feel about the newest Buffalo Bill?
I'm feeling probably like a lot of Buffalonians right now, which is pretty darn good about life in the 716 and beyond for all of Bill's Mafia. I mean, you know, as terrible as last season ended for the Bills, we're going into 2022 here with, man, probably more optimism than I have felt since the early 90s. It's pretty cool.
You know, you have all that, Dave, and I don't know how much you're following this in D.C. You have all the excitement, the new players, and you have Governor Hochul saying Bill Stadium negotiations on track. So right now, everything's looking pretty good.
It is. And, you know, of course, I'm sure there's lots of people out there listening say, well, you know, what's going to screw it up? What's going to be the roadblock? What's going to derail all of this? But at the same time, too, we've been in some pretty bleak places and things have worked their way out. Let's go back to 2014 when we were having lots of conversations about whether the Bills were even going to stay in Buffalo.
That's right.
And so for this to be going in this direction, it does seem to definitely be quite heartening, to say the least, Joe. And yeah, things are definitely looking up, not only on the team front, but also the whole organization front and the whole city front, for that matter, too.
It is. It's a great time, you know. It's a great time to be in Western New York. I will always say that. Not today so much. It's gloomy outside, but a lot of promise going forward, and love being here, being part of it. And Dave, we love when you're going to be back in town. Now, to more serious things, we played at 10:30. We've been doing a weekly update about what's going on in Ukraine. Now, this week, the president of Ukraine had a video message or a video conference with members of Congress. How did that go?
Well, it was about as dramatic as you could have imagined, and a lot of people in Congress were even taken by surprise with the not only the tone and the tenor of the speech that Volodymyr Zelensky had given, but also to the video that was played in conjunction with his speech. Some of the images from that particular video were just unbelievably graphic. It was a very dramatic video, and it was a heart-wrenching one at that, too. And I think for many members of Congress who are getting intelligence briefings and they are reading just reams of information about what's happening there, and they are being told what the United States knows in terms of intelligence about the situation, this really drove home the human element and the tragic personal element of what's happening to the people in Ukraine, as if it was almost happening here in the United States. So in hearing from many members of Congress after this particular speech, I think it changed some of their perspectives, or at least drove it home in a way that hadn't been driven home before. So that has a direct and demonstrable effect on potentially the way that the United States is going to act in response to this invasion that's happening in Ukraine. And as a result, Ukraine's point of doing this, and not only in the United States, I should note, but in Canada and Germany and many other countries too, where President Zelensky is doing exactly what he did in the United States for those countries' government too, having direct addresses to them. He is definitely getting at least some of the things that he wants, if not all of the things that he wants. And I should note that includes a no-fly zone, which no NATO country or the United States certainly has agreed to at this point, and probably in the near to longer-term future.
And the White House reacted right after that speech. We heard from President Joe Biden, and this was putting more restrictions on Russia. Dave, what does the United States have left to sanction Russia? I mean, is there any further action that's not military action that the United States could take?
Yes, there is. So I should note, just to step back, that there has been a very steady and quite quick squeeze that has been happening on the economic front with Russia. So there are quite literally thousands of ways, small and large, that any country, including the United States, can sanction another country with. And the United States has been absolutely aggressive, I guess you could say, in all fairness, in the way that it has taken on Russia from an economic standpoint. So what could be done that isn't being done now? Well, there are still certain types of trade that are going on between the United States and Russia that may not be getting headlines, but there are still pathways to commerce that do exist as we speak right now. Those are beginning to again narrow very quickly, and it is possible, if we're having this conversation in a month, Joe, that there's effectively nothing in a material sense that's happening between the United States and Russia. But as dramatic as these sanctions can be, it's not like flipping a light switch. And some of the sanctions that really fly under the radar specifically are on individuals in Russia. So we oftentimes think of sanctions as country versus country, or something that the United States would be doing to Russia or to Iran or to North Korea. But the United States can also sanction individual people, and that includes all the way on up to Vladimir Putin himself, to members of his government, to Russian oligarchs, to members of a leader or governmental officials' families. And that's one thing that hasn't been done yet, is all the different tools that are at the United States' disposal to put the hurt basically on individuals in Russia who are either supportive of the war, supportive of the war effort, or in the opinion of the United States are not doing enough internally to stop the progress of Russia's assault on the Ukraine at this point.
Dave, you mentioned the no-fly zone, and as you said, all the NATO countries still seemingly against that. But is there anyone in Washington that is trying to push for a no-fly zone? Is it unanimous in Washington against the no-fly zone, or are there individuals, Congress, Senate, members of the White House staff that, you know, are kind of starting to lean towards no-fly zone?
There really isn't at this point, Joe. Now, sure, there are certain voices, perhaps in certain think tanks, that have said, yes, maybe this is a good idea or something we should consider, something we should keep on the table. But among members of the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate and the top officials in the Biden administration on up to Joe Biden, a no-fly zone is really a non-starter. They view that to one extent or another as the United States getting directly involved in the war, and something that, in many of their opinion, would be intervention that could lead to direct military conflict, or might inevitably lead to direct military conflict with Russia. And then we start talking about really, really, really scary things for the United States back home. Would Russia begin to attack the United States directly? Would it begin to attack U.S. allies in NATO, which could trigger a automatic response from other NATO countries against Russia? And the greatest extent to all of this is discussion of, well, would this be the precursor or the trigger to a World War III? And that obviously is about as sobering a prospect as anyone could ever conceive of. So that really is the thinking at this point collectively, if there is a collective thought to be had among members of Congress, both on the right and on the left, Democrats and Republicans, in an age where it's difficult to find unanimity on almost anything, Joe, we are finding near unanimity, if not complete unanimity, on the issue of the United States not creating a no-fly zone or otherwise engaging directly militarily, flying planes over Ukraine, anything of that sort, that would be viewed by Russia or the rest of the world as the United States directly engaging in military conflict.
Definitely something we will continue to keep our eye on. Dave, keeping it in Washington, something you guys have done, again, nonpartisan, you've found people from both sides of the aisle. Continuing, Democrat Senator Sheldon Whitehouse has now, you guys found, violated two conflict of interests. This is on the Politics Insider.
Absolutely. So back in December, we published a massive project. It took us about 5 months to report it out and write it and then publish it, called Conflicted Congress. And what it does is explores all the myriad different ways that Democrats and Republicans, through their personal stock investments and personal financial investments, are either violating a federal conflict of interest law known as the Stock Act, or engaging in stock activity, financial trade activity that very much could be viewed as being in conflict, tantamount to a conflict of interest with their official duties. Sheldon Whitehouse, the senator, Democrat from Rhode Island that you just mentioned, we just had a story of yesterday that indicated that two of his stock trades, one in Tesla and one in Target, the retail store, had been disclosed late after a federal deadline. That's in violation of the Stock Act. We've also had recent reporting, too, Joe, that indicates that there are at least 18 members of Congress who, going back to the situation in Ukraine, who directly personally invest in two defense contractor companies, Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. Well, why should we care about them? Well, because they are the ones who manufacture Javelin and Stinger missiles that the United States and U.S. allies are sending to Ukraine. So, in essence, you have members of Congress who have a personal financial stake in the production of those missiles that the U.S. government itself is sending to Ukraine. Now, nobody's really arguing with the notion of sending that type of weaponry to Ukraine, but the notion of members of Congress profiting off those sales and transactions has caused more than a few people here in Washington, D.C. to scratch their heads. So this is all coming with the backdrop of Congress itself going forward with an effort to potentially ban lawmakers from buying and selling individual stocks so long as they serve in Congress. So there was supposed to be a hearing on it just the past couple of days ago, but the chairman of the committee got COVID, so it got postponed and is likely to be rescheduled for some time in the next few weeks once she recovers from her COVID infection.
You know, I'm glad you brought up COVID because we saw on making the rounds on TV again, Dr. Anthony Fauci talking about, you know, maybe having to go back on those COVID restrictions. What's the feeling of the elected officials in D.C. with COVID? Are people starting to talk about maybe putting mask mandates back in? What is the feel right now when it comes to COVID in D.C. when, you know, hearing from all of these elected officials?
Well, the feeling right now, and this is also Democrats and Republicans, too, I feel like we're talking about more unanimity than you might think here in Washington, but they are very over COVID at this moment. And the case rates physically here in D.C. are very, very low. Most members of Congress are going around without masks. And all you have to do is watch the State of the Union address to see Democrats and Republicans not wearing masks inside as this was being, televised live on national television as Joe Biden was speaking and delivering his State of the Union. So at this moment in time, I think you have most members of the government, with some exceptions, saying, look, let's take this moment. Case counts are low. Schools here in D.C. have made masks optional, and D.C. is a very, 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 very blue city. And people just are seeming to, no pun intended, you know, take a breath of fresh air and not doing anything more than they need to at this point. But you look at case numbers in Europe and other parts of the world where there are new waves that are happening. And one must wonder, and we all must, you know, be vigilant in the sense that the case numbers, although they're low now in many portions of the United States, could be going back up. And you could have a month or two or five or six from now government officials singing a very different tune, and that just speaks to the nature of this pandemic, which is still here and still very alive and real. And especially, man, if you are in Hong Kong right now or certain parts of Asia, it's a whole different story. It's there right now as we were experiencing in December and January with the extreme spike when the Omicron wave took place. So the pandemic is not uniform. The pandemic viruses do what they do. They replicate and they change. And as a result, we are either going to have to change and adapt with it, or we are going to suffer the consequences as much as we would like to have all of this in the rearview mirror. And, you know, you, me, and everyone else would love to see nothing more than that happen.
Another thing I think the White House would like to have in the rearview mirror are gas prices, Dave. We heard a lot of discussion on that. Now, state by state, you have some states that are suspending their gas tax. New York State doesn't seem to be going in that direction. What other ways to relieve or give relief to these gas prices have we heard in Washington and throughout the country?
Yeah, and, you know, these are really, you just mentioned sort of the levers that different states will have. They're limited, but they do make a difference to try to lower gas prices. Now, at the federal level, you can definitely tap the Federal Strategic Petroleum Reserve in order to try to get a temporary relief nationwide of gas prices. You can definitely raise and lower state gas taxes, as you've seen, including very close here to D.C. and Maryland. I live in D.C., but I'm very close to the line with Maryland. And if you go, you know, a couple streets over, the gas prices are definitely demonstrably lower than they are on the D.C. side. So you can expect where people are going to be going for gas when they need to fill up. But, you know, this really underscores a major philosophical issue. If you don't charge a gas tax, well, what happens? Well, that money in many cases goes to repairing roads and bridges and whatnot. And although it's not going to hurt you in the short term, it definitely could hurt governments in the long term in terms of, you know, filling those potholes or making sure that those bridges are in good repair. Things that are not sexy, you do not see when you're driving down the street at this very moment in big neon lights on a sign that says, you know, $4.89 or whatever it is. But, you know, 2 years or 5 years or 10 years down the road, that does make a big difference. And certainly if your car hits a giant pothole and you know, got to spend $250 on a new alignment down the road, that's going to be something that you kind of wish that pothole was filled. So there are consequences to this. And also, too, you know, it really just, I've talked to a lot of people about the gas issue, and I've gotten a variety of opinions. Some people saying, yeah, look, it's really hard. I run a small business. I rely on lower gas prices in order to keep my prices low for my customers. It hurts me in terms of my ability to employ people. If I have unexpected spikes in something that I hope is going to be a lot lower and fixed, like gas prices. And then I've talked to other people who say, look, I am willing to pay an extra 20, 30, 40 cents at the pump per gallon, an extra $5 or $6 every time I fill up, if it means that not a drop of Russian oil is going to go into my gas tank, because there's lots of people in Ukraine who not only don't have gasoline in the first place, but they don't have a home right now. They are displaced. They're living in another country as a result of what's going on. And if I can do one little thing to try to help that situation, then I'm going to do that. So definitely a variety of philosophical thoughts and arguments as to what is the right course of action to go forward with when it comes to this particular issue, Jim.
Dave, Congressman Don Young passed away this week. What can you tell us about the late congressman?
One of the most larger-than-life members of Congress during his many, many, many years there. I believe he served while 10 different U.S. presidents have been in office. And at the age of 88, he was the dean of the U.S. House, the longest-serving member until his death just a couple of days ago. So he was also one of the more idiosyncratic members of Congress. He was inclined to vote with Republicans, but not always, and sometimes would be very conspicuously the lone vote against something that all other members of Congress were voting for, whether it be a budget item, might be another type of bill that the Congress was passing. But he was somebody who, like a lot of folks in Alaska, just very much valued their independence and were not going to be cowed into going any which one way or another. I mean, there's an incredible story about how one time he got into literally a physical altercation with then Speaker John Boehner of the U.S. House and brought a knife to this fight. And John Boehner basically, told him a couple of choice words that we can't say on radio. And, well, they became good friends after that, too. So, I mean, he was somebody who just really did it his own way. Got a lot of money to Alaska, especially for transportation projects, something he was very proud of, even if a lot of government watchdog groups are always calling him the king of pork and trying to get federal money for state projects. But, yeah, he was a character the likes of which we are probably never going to see for a long time, at least in the way that he did it stylistically.
Well, John Boehner, he likes to befriend people after he has fights with them, huh?
John Boehner, another character in his own right. But the two of them together were quite a duo.
Dave, before we let you go, what should we be looking out for this week out of the federal government in D.C.?
Well, I would keep an eye on the America First agenda. This is something where I've noticed a I don't think you can call it a schism just yet, but you've got some of the much more hawkish Republicans who are kind of defining America First, which, of course, is the Trump philosophy of the way that the United States should work. And they're kind of defining America First as being very interventionalist, meaning that the United States should be leading on the international stage when it comes to Ukraine and fighting against Russia, that it should be the strongest voice of all in NATO, and that what is good in Ukraine is good for the United States, and what's bad for Russia is good for the United States, as opposed to taking a much more non-interventionalist type of approach to foreign affairs, which would be sort of the standard Trump-style America First mantra. So there's definitely been some divisions between Donald Trump and hawkish members of the Republican Party in Congress right now, and that's going to be an interesting dynamic going forward because it is relatively new, but it's developing very quickly.
Dave Leventhal, Business Insider. Dave, it's always great to have you on Hardline, and I'm sure we will be talking again very soon.
I hope so. Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you. That is Dave Leventhal. He is from Business Insider, the Deputy Washington Bureau Chief. And if you missed any of that interview, any of our interview with State Senator Ed Rath, or any of our interview with Assemblyman Angelo Morinello, well, you just go to WBEN.com or the Odyssey app and get up to date. I'll talk to you tomorrow afternoon at 2 p.m. as I fill in for Tom Bowerly here on News Radio 930 WBEN.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.